We paused yesterday with those powerful and enigmatic lines. All who would raise the fallen world must come under the dangerous arches of their power. For even the radiant children of the gods to darken their privileges and dreadful right, none can reach heaven who has not passed through hell. These lines are very powerful because they bring in an aspect or a dimension of yoga which is often not spoken of, the aspect of battle. Sri Aurobindo has been very frank and forthright, if I may say so. Often when people go to a master or speak about yoga, not just master is a very big word, there are very few genuine masters. We hear about a technique, a method, and we are promised certain things. But here is Sri Aurobindo, he is openly telling us that look, this yoga has the nature of a battle. In many of his letters, he has revealed this, that though there is a sunlit path, still none can avoid certain amount of difficulties that come in this yoga, and sometimes it can take the nature of a really grim battle. Especially, in fact, no yoga is easy. He says in one of his letters, no yoga is easy. There is nothing like yoga made easy. In one of his letters he writes, like French without tears. You have to go through a certain amount of self-discipline, a certain amount of battle, certain amount of inner war. In one place, much later, he would say, this is the inner war without escape. Man must overcome or miss his higher fate. This is the inner war without escape. And he, as the leader and the hero of this journey, has faced many more battles than we can imagine. What we have to face is a little bit battle with our own little nature. Some difficulties of nature, some small little things, or even what we call as big things. But the battle that he has faced and they have faced, because they had to tackle the whole problem of the earth consciousness. In one of the letters, Sri Aurobindo says that I had to face many more difficulties and the mother 10 times myself, the mother 10 times more than me. And he also reveals that at one time she prayed to the divine that may all the difficulties of the earth come to me so that her children could be made free as is possible in this journey. In one of his letters, in one of his poems, In the Battle, Sri Aurobindo speaks of this side of the yoga. To the world's inconscient power, thou hast given the right to oppose the shining passage of my soul. It levies at each step the tax of night. Doom, her unjust accountant, keeps the roll. So you have given the right, and at each step it asks me for the tax. It doesn't let you pass, and the doom is an unjust accountant. So he said, no, you have not paid. Like, you know, well, we know, we have experienced these things all around in the world, and this he has to face inwardly. And then he goes on, all around me the titan forces press. This earth is theirs, they hold its days in fee. I am full of wounds and the fight merciless. Is this not yet thy hour of victory? In one of the letters, Sri Aurobindo says that my whole life has been a battle and a struggle. Just because I wage it now from a room, it does not mean that the nature of the battle has altered. And why this is even more a battle? Even normal yoga is a battle. We spoke other day of the sharp as a razor's edge. Yoga is like that. It's not a casual walk around the seashore. seashore walking yoga, and you know, we have all kinds of yogas. It's a serious effort, the most sublime adventure that the human spirit has ever imagined. So far it is from the common misconception of this life that, oh, yoga means it's a retired person's place where you can really relax and enjoy peace, escape from world's difficulties. People often label those who have taken to inner life as escapists. And this is very far from escape. In fact, the mother says that if you have not been able to face the battles of life, you cannot face the much tougher battles of the inner life. Outer life itself has the aspect of battle. Inner life is a much greater battle. One is reminded of a small little anecdote of Arjav, the British poet, mathematician who wrote beautiful poetry, died pretty young. When someone asked him that, you know, what do you really do here? he gave a very beautiful reply. He said, coming to grips with our ego. It's nothing visible. Somebody says something and your ego is hurt, and you have to come to grips with your ego, not the other person's ego. Outside, so easy. Somebody says something, you are hurt, you say, "Acha, is that so? I am going to show you. Maybe give you a blow next time." But here, instead of doing that, you have to come to grips with your own ego. Something so much more difficult than one can even imagine. And this is the aspect of the yoga. Nalnida has reminded of this in his message, that to do Sri Aurobindo's yoga, one always had to be a hero warrior. But of course, he tells us that there is another way, is to become a child of the Divine Mother. This is another way of doing yoga, but very easy to hear, but very difficult to be, because a child abandons oneself completely in the mother's hands. How she carries, which way she will carry, what experience she will give, not give. Completely obedient, given, frank, transparent. That is the other way. Otherwise, the yoga has this aspect of the battle. And in this two cantos, Sri Aurobindo is revealing to us just a fragment, I'm sure, because what he must have gone through for years and years, sitting in the room, we cannot imagine. Often when questions were asked to him that you must be busy enjoying in the supramental heights, and he would remind them, no, I am not busy with the Empyrean, but with the abyss. Because that is the problem. If it is a yoga of escape from the world, there is a difficulty, but less of a problem. Because after a while, the universal nature gives way. But this earth is theirs. They hold its days in fee. So these powers have ruled earth for, since the time it came into existence. Even before matter was born, they were there. And matter itself was formed by a kind of occult action of these powers and the touch of the force of life and the divine forces in the inconscient. So from that moment, they hold it at ransom. And even though the light keeps growing little by little, they still claim it, that we are the ones who have the sole right to this throne, because we are the firstborn, first children. And that's why the struggle. So we continue this plunge. It's not yet over. But it's very interesting. As we go through these next few pages, we'll discover that we have really we are on the verge, if we have not already touched the rock bottom, which Sri Aurobindo touches in his yoga long, long back. And now it has to be reproduced in the outer life. This too, the traveler of the worlds must dare. A warrior in the dateless dual strife. He entered into dumb, despairing night, challenging the darkness with his luminous soul. This is the true battle, the inner battle. Probably this is the original sense of the word, being an inner warrior. But, you know, inner war is much more difficult. It's much easier to have an outer battle. And outwardly, it becomes represented. This inner battle sometimes takes an outer form. And that's what Sri Aurobindo has spoken of the Second World War. The same battle between the evolutionary power and the retrogressive power, which is the inconscient, which pulls the earth back again and again, humanity into a beastly state, and this evolutionary power, which is constantly laboring and struggling to uplift human consciousness towards divinity. Sometimes this struggle becomes very acute and can even precipitate in outer forms. We have the story of the Mahabharata, where Sri Krishna declares very openly that Arjuna, it's not your battle. Don't think it is you and your kingdom and your brothers and your wife and her prestige. It is none of these things. It's a battle whose import humanity will bear for centuries to come. You have to fight. If you don't fight, somebody else will fight. Doesn't matter. This is the battle of the ages. And Sri Aurobindo, in a same vein, similar vein, declares that this war, the Second World War, is not any nation's war. It is the mother's war. Depending on which side wins, the earth will eventually, nobody can, stifle the plan, but it can be delayed. The earth may be thrown back thousands of years in its evolutionary journey if one side wins. But this is an extreme example. This battle is being fought on many planes, and most of all it is being fought inside. Alarming with his steps the threshold gloom, he came into a fierce and dolorous realm, peopled by souls who never had tasted bliss. Probably this is the mythical fall where one, you know, Milton speaks of, where one really goes into a state where one feels one is abandoned. Actually, nobody is ever abandoned, but one feels it's a state where one has never ever tasted joy. This is a state of utter joylessness. Ignorant, like men born blind who know not light. They could equate worst ill with highest good. We have the inversion of this inner war in the form of the modern jihad, where the worst kind of ill is being equated with the highest good. It's an inversion. The shadow uses the same terms, the same things, and it imitates and creates a kind of replica and creates doom and destruction for earth. They could equate worst ill with highest good. Virtue was to their eyes a face of sin, and evil and misery were their natural state. So we often speak about dialogue and speaking and, you know, communicating. We don't know what kind of forces we are dealing with. When Gandhi and others spoke of, you know, when Hitler comes, give them the homes, but keep your hearts to yourself. And he was talking of all this. So Sri Aurobindo remarked, he doesn't know what he's speaking. You are dealing with forces which know not any sense of truth, light. They don't know that. They would not ask a better condition than this. That in the name of goodness, you tell them, please come and occupy our houses. You know, we are very virtuous. Don't you realize we are so virtuous? They will say, very good, thank you. Come and occupy, push you out and be very, very happy. So these beings and forces do not know this. Virtue was to their eyes a face of sin, and evil and misery were their natural state. A dire administration's penal code, making of grief and pain the common law. That was the way of their life. How they would administer, the only thing they knew was to give grief and pain, to inflict suffering. Decreeing universal joylessness. In fact, in this kind of I don't know what to use the word. The word religion is so much degraded. But any activity which is creative and which can be joy, like painting, music, etc., are banned. We're not supposed to painting, poetry, music. They are banned. Photography is banned because, well, it gives a little joy. So joy is banned because this is a state of utter joylessness. And torture into a daily festival. An act was passed to chastise happiness. Laughter and pleasure were banned as deadly sins. A questionless mind was ranked as wise content. So only those were welcome who would not raise a word, not question the law, not question whatever is happening around. They could live in that world. These worlds are also projected in the outer life because this earth, human earth, contains everything. So these worlds are also there. A dull heart's silent apathy as peace. Sleep was not there, torpor the soul rest. So, couple of lines below. Around him grew the terror of a world of agony, followed by worse agony. And in the terror, a great wicked joy, glad of one's own and others' calamity. Their thought and life were a long punishment. Many of the people, Mother has of course spoken of it in great detail, and Ish Upanishad gives a hint of it, that those who destroy their own being, they enter into a great sunless worlds, Asurya Naam Te Loka. And the Mother has spoken of those who commit suicide under a state of utter agony, despair. They are basically at that point of time driven by the hostile forces, because these forces of the darkest worlds take away hope and fill them with despair that there is no way out, I cannot survive. And whatever you may tell them, whatever reason you may give, whatever light you may throw, they are in its grip. For a moment they feel supported if they come perchance in the atmosphere of someone who carries some love and peace in the heart. They feel supported for a while. But the moment they are left to themselves, they again feel the same despairing gloom. So their thought and life are a long punishment when one is caught in that state. And it's very difficult for somebody who has not experienced it to really understand that what is there rationally and every way you are seeing. But that person, to that person, really thought, life becomes something like a punishment. And each day becomes so dull, heavy, difficult. The breath a burden and all hope a scourge. The body a field of torment, a masked unease. It's really graphic description, and we can see how people who are caught in its grip, what a difficult situation it is. Repose was a waiting between pang and pang. This was the law of things none dreamed to change. A hard, somber heart, a harsh, unsmiling world, rejected happiness like a cloying sweet. Tranquility was a tedium and ennui. Only by suffering, life grew colorful. It needed the spice of pain, the salt of tears. If one could cease to be, all would be well. So eventually, one is driven to this state of utter despair, where death seems the only door of escape. Of course, it is not a door of escape, but this is the way these forces grip the human consciousness and earth. And they are the ones that keep pulling down everything towards the abyss, even otherwise. Even otherwise, they are responsible for this slow catching up of death and its forces and powers. And no vitamin E and vitamin A and all the beauty lotions help, because the cause are very deep inside. That's what Shubindu says, that even if you were to scientifically take care of all the outward causes of death, yet death will find its door, because the real cause of death is within. It is this which keeps drawing everything, pulling down from the moment one is born towards the abyss. And it's a great struggle, but normally, of course, because of the divine presence, things are lifted up. Else only fear sensations gave some rest, some zest. A fury of jealousy burning the gnawed heart. That's why of all the deadly poisons that man has known, it is not potassium cyanide. It is jealousy. Potassium cyanide destroys the body. Fair enough. But jealousy destroys the soul. Mother has spoken of this. It's, and humanity is universally fond of this poison and takes it like a strengthening wine. So he is reminding us, a fury of jealousy burning the gnawed heart. This is the origin of jealousy, and we must remember next time that if we shelter jealousy, we are sheltering this being inside. The sting of murderous spite and hate and lust. They immediately steal the joy from the person. The whisper that lures to the pit and treachery stroke through vivid spots on the dull aching hours. So if Macbeth must live, he lives by that spite and hate, because otherwise he doesn't feel alive. And after having done it, he wallows in the mud of guilt and sin. Either ways, these forces have a hold his consciousness in their grip. Few lines below, of such fierce stuff was made up life's long hell. So this is hell. If somebody wants to know where is hell in the human life, well, wherever there is jealousy, hate, murderous spite, there is hell. Because actually, literally, these forces are holding that consciousness completely in the grip. And there, joy is taken away, the smile is robbed, and one is in worst of agonies. Actually, the person who is jealous suffers much more than the person on whom it is the worst, punishment one can inflict on oneself. Because eventually, who is suffering? One is oneself suffering. So this is the pattern of which life's long hell was made. These were the threads of the dark spider's web. The Upanishads describe this creation as emerging from a luminous spider. How? Because spider is at the center. From within him, all the webs come out. From within, out of his own substance. So this world is created out of the divine by his own substance. And he is in it. So it's a very interesting description of the Upanishads. Out of himself he brings forth. And yet he is distinct from it. He is part of the web, but he can break free from the web and move away. So it is literally a worldwide web. But there is another kind of worldwide web, not just the divine worldwide web. That is behind. This is a dark spider's worldwide web. And many lives are caught in its, as Shubhendu has put it, in its dark and ambiguous net, and it swallows them. These were the threads of the dark spider's web in which the soul was caught, quivering and wrapped. This was religion, this was nature's rule. In that realm, not that this is religion in its highest, religion like occultism and spiritual philosophy and spiritual experience is one of the preparatory foundations for human life. But everything these beings have distorted. But in this place, this was religion. In a fell chapel of iniquity to worship a black, pitiless image of power. The next few lines that we are going to read, this is actually on earth a place that corresponds to it. I'm not going to name it. Some of us will recognize it. This is actually a place where you worship a dark black stone and you cross the floor which is full of hard stones kneeling down. Now here Shubhendu describes it, but he's describing an inner world which gets projected outwardly. This was religion, this was nature's rule, in a fell chapel of iniquity to worship a black pitiless image of power. And one of the things people do there as ritual is they throw stones on that, image of power. Kneeling, one must cross hard-hearted stony courts, a pavement like a floor of evil fate, because it, you know, you suffer as you cross. It's a literal description. Each stone was a keen edge of ruthless force. It's not marble. And glued with the chilled blood from tortured breasts, the dry, gnarled trees stood up like dying men, stiffened into a pose of agony. And from each window peered an ominous priest, chanting Te Deums for slaughter's crowning grace. Uprooted cities, blasted human homes, burned writhen bodies, the bomb shells massacre. So we have touched the darkest spot. Shobindo has seen all this. If we don't know, if we think that, oh, Shobindo was sitting in a room and try to imitate, some people shut themselves off in a room. So they think they are doing Shobindo's yoga just because they've shut themselves in a room. Shobindo has said that, why I am not coming out and acting? Because I have now other means which are much more powerful to act. There is a letter of Shobindo where he says, my retirement is not a retirement from world action. I am much more active with means which don't require actual physical presence. And in that letter he says, twice I have intervened physically. One was when the Second World War was there, where he openly gave a letter and declaration, and he even contributed to the war fund. They took an amount, ₹1,000 those days, quite a lot. And second time during the Cripps mission, when it came to India, he sent an emissary. He says, twice I intervened physically. But both times he discovered that people are not receptive to this intervention. So he says, therefore, I resorted back to the old method of acting silently without their knowledge. Then they are more receptive. When the thing was sent, then they immediately react and they close. And silently he acts. So he was working day and night from those rooms, keeping a sleepless vigil over the night and the world. So it's not a question of just shutting oneself into a room. We have to read the newspaper to know what is happening in the world. And Shobindo writes in one of his poems that how London and Paris and Tokyo, my spirits seeing are. I am the beast he slays, the bird he feeds and saves. All the things that were happening. The mother speaks in similar vein in the agenda when she speaks of the transformation of the body, very interestingly. Anything that is happening there, she's experiencing it in her cells. A hemorrhage there, everything, because all the maladies, disorders have their roots inside, deep inside matter, the inconscient foundation. And Shobindo has plunged into that and gone right into the depths of the darkness. Uprooted cities, blasted human homes, burned writhen bodies, the bomb shells massacre. Our enemies are fallen, they sang. All who once stayed our will are smitten and dead. How great we are, how merciful art thou. They literally use this phrase that, Lord, thou art all merciful, and then go on to do this kind of deeds. And we think that by just mind's intellectual process, it is a greater power. In one of the places, the mother says, it's only a power greater than evil that can conquer it. Because it's something has its roots right into the very darkest abyss, and that is coming out. It was needed to be expunged. We have this analogy in the Gita, in the Mahabharata. Sri Krishna tells Arjuna, everything I have destroyed, but it has to be now enacted on the earthly scene. So everything that Sri Aurobindo has done in his consciousness, Sri Aurobindo and the mother have done, that will be enacted on the earthly scene. And there would be instruments, there would be things happening like that. It is unfortunately the only way that earth progresses. They gave a sunlit path that though it has been done in consciousness, you may not need to go through it. But humanity is not receptive. It still clings to that darkness and even praises it. All who once stayed our will are smitten and dead. How great we are, how merciful art thou. Thus thought they to reach God's impassive throne and him command whom all their acts opposed, magnifying their deeds to touch his skies and make him an accomplish of their crimes. There no relenting pity could have place, but ruthless strength and iron moods had sway. Few lines below, it was a world of sorrow and of hate. Sorrow with hatred for its lonely joy, hatred with other sorrow as its feast. So again, we come back to the same thing. If we can at least remain happy and we ourselves don't wallow in sorrow, we reduced little burden of the divine on this world. This is the minimum work given to us. Whatever outer work we may do or not do. Mother has spoken of this. That my child, if you can remain happy, it reduces the burden of at least one person's sorrow in this world, which the divine has to bear. This is how we can help. This is too much for us. But like a little squirrel, chipmunk, we can at least put a little bit of sand into the sea. And they've given us the secret of this joy. These passions, even objects, seem to exude. This is a very deep occult truth Sri Aurobindo is revealing to us, that objects are not objects, but imprints of consciousness can stay there. In one of his writings in the Upanishads, Sri Aurobindo says that if you give a sword in the hand of a yogi, by even 300 years old, by holding it, he will be able to say all the things that have been committed by it, all the acts, because the imprints are there. Even the mother says there is a place in the earth where, you know, all the past exists like a memory bank, and one can go there and retrieve and know things directly. And very often in one of her later passages, she says, historians don't know anything because they always go by outward facts. But the real things of events of history, nobody records. Who can record this life of Sri Aurobindo? Because this is not something seen on the surface. And this is the real, much more intimate to him. If you would ask him, what were you doing, sir, in your room? He will not say, I was sitting and gazing and, once in a while eating this food, sleeping so many hours and writing letters. This is what he was doing. But this is not visible to the human eyes. And this is a big problem because this is the real history. There was one... Once when a story was being shown, I forget which film was being shown, and when mother saw it, she said, but this is not how it happened. She saw and she knew this is not how it happened. It happened in another way. So there is the imprint even on the objects. Of course, the good side of this truth is that even material objects can carry the imprints of higher things. And that is the whole purpose or the whole deeper meaning and significance of the relics. The relic of anything, of course, we know this side, other side. Many people have used material objects to cast a spell. Of course, not everybody can come under spell by any material object. Most people have something within which resist it. And of course, certain degree of either receptivity or openness is required. But any material object can be charged also in the other way. That is the meaning of the blessing packets. She used to charge it with her force and they contain that touch. But there is the other side, the dark side of this. That's why in all traditions there is a white magic and a black magic. So white magic is the powers and forces and consciousness of the gods using instruments, even sometimes material objects, for their purpose. And this is a black magic where the dark powers and forces can use even material objects. But here Sri Aurobindo is describing of that native world where these objects are there. But the same thing, as I said, earth, it can be reflected upon earth. These passions, even objects, seem to exude, for mind overflowed into the inanimate. We don't realize that our thoughts and everything is circulating in the atmosphere, desires, thoughts, everything, and is touching everything that flowing into it, seeping into material objects. Even one can become sensitive enough, chairs, books, things handled by someone, even houses carry it. So that's why this idea that some houses are haunted, there is a certain truth in all these things. That if a consciousness occupies a particular house, it carries its imprint, and many people feel it. That answered with the wickedness it received against their users, used malignant powers, hurt without hands, and strangely, suddenly slew. So these objects can become attractors of these forces. We have the famous incidents when in the ashram stones were being thrown through the power of this black magic somebody was trying. And within a certain area, vicinity of the ashram, he couldn't throw these stones. Then they became frequent. And then when the matter finally came to notice, to cut a long story short, they found that there was a new servant who was employed. And this worker was like a medium, and he was attracting these forces. Through him, these materialized stones could come. And behind this materialization, there were these vital entities, and of course the whole thing ended in a both humorous way and a kind of compassionate way. When mother saw these powers, they started fleeing. They said, but we can serve you also. And she asked, what can you do? They said, we can throw stones. Mother said, I have no need of you. And the whole magic fell back upon the person who became seriously ill. And Sri Aurobindo had this to say, what, death for a few stones? So that is the vastness. But the thing is true that human beings and objects can become instruments of such forces. So this is what Sri Aurobindo is reminding us, that though these things exist in their native worlds, sometimes human beings can become their instrument, which we have read in the previous lines also earlier, yesterday. An evil environment worsened evil souls. All things were conscious there and all perverse. Of course, here soul is not in the sense that souls are evil, but the core, here soul again, like previous thing, the core of these people was evil. All things were conscious there and all perverse. In this infernal realm, he dared to press even into its deepest pit and darkest core, perturbed its tenebrous base, dared to contest its ancient privileged right and absolute force. In night, he plunged to know her dreadful heart. In hell, he sought the root and cause of hell. This is the work of Sri Aurobindo. This is labor, which he beautifully brings out in his poem, A God's Labor. A voice cried, go where none has gone. Dig deeper, deeper yet, till thou reach the grim foundation stone and knock at the keyless gate. I saw that a falsehood was planted deep at the very root of things, where the grey sphinx guards God's riddle sleep. On the dragon's outspread wings, I left the surface gods of mind and life's unsatisfied seas, and plunged into body's alleys blind, into her nether mysteries. Through the body's blind alleys, through matter, he plunges right into the bosom of the pit. on a desperate stair my feet has trod, armored with boundless peace. So this is, you know, in those television shows you show bungee jumping and all this, and they give a disclaimer. This is practiced only by experts in the field. This is not for anybody and everybody. So it is not for anybody and everybody. This is Shivabindu could do it. Why? Because on a desperate stair my feet have trod, armored with boundless peace, carrying the fires and the splendors of God into the human abyss. So what we have to do? Mother was asked, Mother, you are doing such a difficult yoga, 13 volumes of agenda. What? We cannot imagine. How can we do this? This is very difficult. Mother says, but my child, where am I asking you to do this? Am I asking you to do this? So Mother, what have we to do? You have to just open yourself towards me. I am doing it for you. I am doing it because nobody else can do it. And then she says, because I have been asked to do it. This is not something very pleasant to do. I have been asked to do it. I am not asking you to do it. You have to just open yourself and receive. And yet see how things can work. Now there is a latest trend that people want to do the yoga of the cells as is documented in the agenda and records of yoga. This is how it attracts, fine, come. And there is nothing more dangerous than entering into the abyss. Sri Aurobindo, before he came to Pondicherry, we should not forget that he already had all the major realizations, Vasudevam Sarvamiti, cosmic consciousness, Nirvana. And in 1912, he writes in a letter that most of the time in a day, I am able to dwell permanently in the Parabrahman. What is Parabrahman? Where time and timelessness sink in that sea. Time becomes a wave and space a wandering drop. After that, he says, I plunged into the body's Alice blind, into her nether mysteries. He's not asking us to do this. He's just telling us the difficulty of God's labor so that we can be a little patient. And when bombs burst and there is chaos, we should not think, oh, he did not know about this. He's telling us, I know this very well. And because I know its solution too. We'll come back after the break.